From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
I'm Tanya Mosley. It's Here and Now. We're now entering day 7 of Turkey's attack against the Kurds in northern Syria. And today, Syrian state media is reporting that government forces there raised the Syrian national flag in Manbij, a town held by the Kurds. President Trump's decision to withdraw U.S. troops cleared the way for this Turkish offensive. Now, after criticism of that decision, President Trump is slapping sanctions on Turkey. But so far, targeting the country's economy has not slowed down the fight. NPR's Peter Kenyon is in the southeastern Turkey region and joins us now. And Peter, tell us more about the significance of Syrian troops taking over this town of Manbij.
Well, this is an area that was seized from Islamic State fighters by these Syrian Kurdish fighters, the YPG, that Turkey is now attacking. Back then, the YPG was supported by the U.S. military. Those troops are, of course, now withdrawing. Faced with the loss of American support, the YPG decided to invite Syrian government troops loyal to President Bashar al-Assad to come north. That was a major shift, and those government forces did quickly arrive, now deploying at Manbij, an area that Turkish-led forces had said they were going to take. So it's just one of the latest signs of how fluid and complicated this is.
Yeah, it sounds very complicated. Is there a concern about troops from Turkey and Syria clashing?
That's certainly a scenario that could make things even worse than they are now. This is, as I mentioned, though, a very complicated conflict zone. There are Turkish armed forces backed by artillery and air cover. Then there are other Turkish-backed forces calling themselves the Syrian National Army. They used to be known as the Free Syrian Army. These fighters have come in for criticism for alleged abuses in the field. There have been videos appearing to show them shooting unarmed prisoners by the roadside, things like that. And then if you want to add more complication, there's the increasing Russian involvement. Moscow, of course, being Assad's most important ally right now, perhaps followed by Iran. The Russian Defense Ministry says Russian military police are patrolling an area in between the Syrian government forces and the Turkish forces. But the potential for future clashes is certainly there.
We have been talking all morning about these new sanctions imposed by the Trump administration. What has been the response from Turkey?
Well, Ankara has said ever since this possibility of sanctions was raised that this is a national security matter, full stop. This operation will not be curtailed because of economic pressure. And as a practical matter, the sanctions just announced are not all that painful, certainly in the short term. There is a boosting of tariffs on imports of Turkish steel, for instance. But the U.S. doesn't buy much, if any, Turkish steel. And now there have been talks on a big trade deal that's appear to be blocked now. That's also not an immediate hardship for Turkey, so there isn't any real impact from that yet.
We've also been hearing a lot about American troops leaving. What does this actually look like? What do we know about that effort to get them out of there?
Well, we've been discussing the Manbij area, and there are reports the U.S. forces have left. The entire pullout, we're told, is expected to take a couple of weeks. That's according to a U.S. official. And a good deal of coordination has been necessary in hopes of ensuring the safety of the American forces as they withdraw.
You mentioned Syria's borders. Give us a sense of what's happening on the ground, what you see the border with Turkey, but also with Iraq.
Well, yes. Over on the other side of the border, the news that the government forces were coming north really changed the dynamic on the ground. Civilians, foreign aid workers, journalists all headed to the Iraqi border. Aid workers in particular say it's a classic bad situation from a humanitarian point of view. The situation is getting more critical, the aid is more needed, and yet conditions on the ground are too insecure to allow them to stay in country and provide the assistance. Now, here on this side of the Syria-Turkey border, the situation is also difficult for civilians. Obviously, the attacking has mostly gone the other way into Syria, but there's been a regular stream of attacks coming the other way. Turkish Defense Ministry says its forces responded to one of the attacks, the one coming from the Manbij region, as it happens, and claims to have killed 15 Kurdish fighters. While the military operation is broadly popular in much of Turkey, here close to the border, the sentiment is more of a fervent wish that it will all be over soon.
It sounds so volatile and chaotic. There are also these fears of the reemergence of the Islamic State group in Syria. What's being done to prevent this?
Well, at the moment, we're hearing a lot of concern, more than prevention. The French foreign minister voiced that very concern today. He said the operation could make the resurgence of ISIS inevitable. This has been one of the main complaints from the start, that this Turkish operation could undo years of work to reclaim territory from ISIS fighters, who, as you know, declared a caliphate in parts of Syria and Iraq. And there are numerous ISIS prisoners who've been held at camps that were guarded by these YPG Kurdish fighters. Those guards have reportedly been thinned out since the Turkish operation began. Turkey has responded to this criticism by saying it's prepared to take responsibility for these ISIS prisoners. That's been greeted skeptically by some. The White House is dispatching Vice President Mike Pence now. He's heading a delegation to Turkey. Whether he can convey something that'll change the mind of Turkish leader Recep Tayyip Erdogan and his generals is something a lot of folks will be watching to see.
Yes, I know you'll be following all of this. NPR's Peter Kenyon, thank you for speaking with us.
Thanks, Tanya.
Well, in Washington today, George Kent, Deputy Assistant Secretary of State, is being asked behind closed doors by House lawmakers what he knows about President Trump's request that Ukrainian officials investigate Joe Biden. Yesterday, former White House Russia adviser Fiona Hill reportedly told lawmakers in this impeachment inquiry that Trump lawyer Rudy Giuliani ran a shadow foreign policy in Ukraine to Trump's personal benefit. She said her boss, former National Security Advisor John Bolton, referred to Giuliani as a hand grenade that was going to blow everybody up. Shane Harris, intelligence and national security reporter for The Washington Post, is here. Hi, Shane.
Hi.
So let's hear more about what Fiona Hill is reported to have said. You and others report that she told lawmakers she was alarmed about a July meeting just days before President Trump's phone call to the Ukrainian president in which Trump asked for a Biden investigation. We know that because of the transcript. What did Hill find alarming about that meeting?
Well, I think what she found alarming was that Rudy Giuliani, the president's personal lawyer, appeared to be conducting this kind of shadow investigation that was aimed more at the president's political rivals than having anything to do with U.S. foreign policy. And this was completely cutting out officials on the National Security Council who are supposed to be coordinating U.S. foreign policy. So as Hill becomes aware of this and her superiors as well, it's becoming clear to them that Rudy Giuliani is sort of off acting as a rogue operative in ways that they can't completely understand and that could be politically imperiling the presidency.
Well, there were also people taking direction from him apparently because she said she confronted Ambassador Gordon Sondland for saying that the investigations that President Trump wanted in Ukraine needed to be restarted. Now, he testifies Thursday. He's the one quoted in texts that were released telling a worried diplomat that there was no quid pro quo in exchange for Ukraine conducting those Biden investigations. Now, it's being reported that he's going to say the president told him to say that.
That's right. We reported this recently in the Post that he's going to say that the content of that text message was relayed to him by the president himself. And this message struck many people when they saw it as sounding kind of very formal and almost as if he was trying to establish in the record, no, 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 there's no concern for a quid pro quo, when clearly that is what is being raised with him by this diplomat that he is having a text exchange with. So Ambassador Sondland appears to be prepared to say, look, I was just following direction from the president here, and we'll say he doesn't know if the president was being truthful or not, but that is what the president told him to say in this text message.
We mentioned the departed Bolton calling Giuliani a hand grenade. Hill also said in her testimony that she told him about that July meeting. What else does he say about Giuliani, and will he testify?
Well, that's going to be a very interesting question. We reported last night that there are some discussions, at least preliminary, about having Ambassador Bolton come up to testify. We understand that after this meeting where this Gordon Sondland actually blurted out to a number of diplomats who were in the meeting as well as Mr. Bolton, that he went ballistic after hearing about this, that essentially Sondland was keying them in, that there were these investigations that needed to be started up again. I think Ambassador Bolton would be able to testify both to that meeting as well as what awareness he had, if any, about what Rudy Giuliani was up to and who he was taking his orders from.
Adam Schiff, who leads one of these inquiries, has said that the transcripts of these closed-door meetings, you know, might be released soon. But Republicans are making much of the fact that these are closed-door meetings. They think that that means and they have said that that means that it's just going to be leaked information and the American public won't get to see what's really being said. Why are they closed-door meetings?
Well, one reason from the Democrats' point of view is they don't want future witnesses who haven't come up yet being able to calibrate or change their testimony or adjust it based on what was heard before. So that's a part of it. Also, this is kind of analogous to a grand jury proceeding, Democrats say, in which you have secret testimony. You don't actually have a chance to cross-examine witnesses. They say that the impeachment process, when you be preceding the part where the House would actually vote to send it over to the Senate for a trial, that's more like a grand jury. And so the secrecy is allowed and maybe even appropriate under the circumstances.
You got 30 seconds. What's the most disturbing thing you, an intelligence and national security reporter, have heard so far?
I mean, really, this whole issue of Rudy Giuliani going out, conducting investigations on his own and cutting the NSC out of the loop, that is extraordinary and potentially very dangerous because he's a private citizen. We don't know what he's telling the president, and he's imperiling the presidency really by engaging in this possible quid pro quo. This is kind of rogue behavior that we're just not used to seeing in the conduct of U.S. foreign policy.
Shane Harris of The Washington Post, thank you.
Thank you.
This message comes from NPR sponsor MindBody. MindBody connects millions to the widest variety of local fitness classes, and they offer the same experience when it comes to massage and acupuncture, spas and salons. Find, book, and pay all in one place. Owners can join the network at mindbodyonline.com/NPR. MindBody, your access to the largest consumer wellness network and marketplace.
A quarter of the nation's homeless people live in the state of California. And we've heard reports for years now about the impact of the crisis in places like Los Angeles and San Francisco. But smaller cities and towns are also experiencing an uptick, including Bakersfield, California. Megan Person is a director of countywide communication for Kern County.
In Kern County, we have a huge population of people who are within 1 to 2 paychecks of homelessness. Our job as a county is to help move those people into more stable situations. So when you have a population that is about like 46% is within 1 to 2 paychecks of homelessness, a broken refrigerator
can make the difference.
It can change the entire outlook.
There is a radical approach on the table now to fight the homeless crisis in Kern County, where Bakersfield sits. The sheriff there is proposing locking up some homeless people for drug and other misdemeanor offenses. It's an approach that has largely been out of favor for decades now, so we decided to visit Kern County to learn more. One of our first stops was the Mission at Kern County, a place where people experiencing homelessness can go for a hot meal, overnight shelter, and clothing.
It's me, James Baker Davis III.
It's also where we met James Baker Davis III. He was in the shade on a bench, in the middle of catching a break from the oppressive heat, 91 degrees in October. Baker Davis is from Bakersfield, and for years now, he's been sleeping in relatives' cars in city parks. Recently, he's noticed more folks like him out on the street, going to great lengths to find a safe place to sleep.
People all over the blocks, sleeping at the park 10 right now. They know when to move the stuff, you know, on the streets while you're on the ground. Then there were times the sprinklers come on.
So they know when
they put a pot over it, a bucket, cover it up. It's going to come on. It won't wear it out. We'll be asleep.
What Baker Davis is saying is true. There's been a 50% increase in the number of homeless people living in Kern County compared to last year. Part of the uptick is that the county deployed more people last March, 300 volunteers, to do a comprehensive count of the homeless population. Jim Wheeler, executive director of Flood Ministries, has spent his entire career helping homeless people find places to live. I asked him to describe the situation in Bakersfield.
If I could quote Spinal Tap, we're at 11, right? That's how I feel sometimes, that we're at 11, right? It's a crisis.
There are lots of reasons, Wheeler says, for the crisis. For one, it is expensive to live in California. And then there is another more contentious reason.
You have some bad public policy. Mm-hmm. Prop 47 and Prop 57 and, you know, some of the policies.
Wheeler focuses in on Prop 47 specifically, the Safe Neighborhoods and Schools Act, which passed in 2014, reclassifying low-level felonies to misdemeanors, crimes like possessing drugs, shoplifting, and forging checks for small amounts. This action was an attempt to reduce overcrowding in the California state prison system. And 5 years later, some folks like Wheeler believe there have been consequences.
So you have people who are on the street right now who would normally be in jail. And I'm not advocating that we put people who are experiencing homelessness in jail. I'm just saying that I think there is definitely a correlation between that and the number of homeless people who are, have substance abuse issues that are on the street.
During the county count, Wheeler says 68% of the homeless population in Kern County reported struggling with substance abuse problems.
This problem is getting bigger and bigger and bigger. These people have become enabled. They've become empowered. The people who are panhandling are more aggressive. There's a lot of problems that go along with this.
That's Kern County Sheriff Donnie Youngblood. He's now proposing a radical idea. The county, he says, has over 600 empty jail beds, and he's ready to use them by arresting homeless people who commit crimes like drug possession and other minor offenses.
So if we run into someone who is in possession of heroin or methamphetamine, there wouldn't be a ticket. We would take them to jail and we'd book them in jail. They would then be arraigned in front of a judge who would decide whether they should be released or whether they should be kept in custody until they have a trial. And then if they plead guilty or they have a trial, a judge would then sentence them to a certain amount of time, in the up to 1 year, in the county jail. During all this time, those programs are available to them. We have RSAP programs, Residential Substance Abuse Program. We have kiosks for them to work on their child support because that gets a lot of them in trouble. They don't pay their child support. We have anger management. We help them get a driver's license. We also want to make sure that they have follow-up with mental health or with drug counselors after they leave jail. We don't want you just to be a good person while you're in jail and change your life. We want you to change your life after you're released so that we don't see you again.
This idea flies in the face of criminal justice reforms over the last decade that seeks to decriminalize drug use, viewing it as more of a health concern than a criminal act.
This sounds expensive, and we know that throughout the country, court systems are overburdened by court cases. How do you plan to make this work and pay for all of this?
Well, you're right. It is expensive because I'm having to hire new staff because those empty jail beds that I have, I don't have staff for. So that's going to be expensive. There's no question about that. But is it more expensive than what we're doing right now? Because we're doing nothing with these people in the streets.
Jim Wheeler with Flood Ministries does not think the answer is to lock people up. But he does feel there is a more nuanced approach that could involve law enforcement.
I do not believe we can criminalize our way out of homelessness. But in certain circumstances, I think that you sort of need the carrot and the stick, right? And the carrot is, hey, we have a shelter bed for you. We have that'll have mental health services. It'll have substance abuse treatment services. We'll help you get your vital documents so you can get housing. We'll help you find a landlord. We'll help you get a voucher. That's the carrot. But people don't want to accept the carrot right now. So the stick is you either have to go to the shelter or, you know, you could face being cited by the sheriff's department.
The county is in the beginning stages of creating a low-barrier shelter, a place that accepts people on a short-term basis who can't find shelter anywhere else, like those with drug addiction problems. The low-barrier description is a way to deal with what Jim Wheeler calls the three Ps: partners, pets, and possessions.
When we're out on the street and we talk to people, we ask them, what's the barrier? Why won't you go to the shelter? And well, because right now in Kern County, if you go to a shelter and you're a male, you got to go to the mission. And if you're female, you go to the homeless center. And so if you're a partner, you have to split up. People don't want to do that. If you have a pet, I love our shelter operators. They're great. But neither of our current shelters will accept pets. And then what do you do with all their stuff, right? One man's, trash is another man's treasure. When somebody sees, people pushing around in a shopping cart may look like trash to us, but that's really important to that individual. What are you going to do? How are you going to promise that individual you're going to take care of their possessions if they go to the shelter? That's what we're working on, designing that. Because I always say that shelter is not a destination, right? Our goal is not to put people in a shelter and just warehouse people. Our goal is to move people off the streets and into stable housing.
Back at the mission, both of these ideas, the low barrier shelter and arresting homeless people who commit minor crimes, the carrot and the stick, so to speak, are actually appealing to James Baker Davis. It's difficult and painful, he says, to live out on the streets, which he says he has been doing for years. And criminals, he says, are just as dangerous for the housed as they are for the homeless.
Not for trespassing, don't lock them up for that. Give them a ticket or something. But other offenses, they keep doing it. Yes.
Other cities over the years have also considered similar actions, but many of them, which target people for loitering or trespassing, have not gone past the initial phase. Sheriff Youngblood's idea, in partnership with the county district attorney, is still in its early stages. It has to go through several steps of approval. Meanwhile, Kern County says they hope to have the new low-barrier shelter open by the end of the year. And as we mentioned earlier, a quarter of the nation's homeless people live here in California, and hardly a day goes by when there's not a story about it. Today's Los Angeles Times reports on a federal court ruling that prohibits ticketing or arresting unsheltered people for camping on public property if authorities don't have a shelter bed to offer people. That ruling came out of a case involving Boise, Idaho. Los Angeles is one of the cities that has filed a brief asking the U.S. Supreme Court to consider a challenge to that ruling.
This message comes from NPR's sponsor, Indeed. When it comes to hiring, you don't have time to waste. You need help getting to your short list of qualified candidates fast. With Indeed, post a job in minutes, set up screener questions, then zero in on qualified candidates. And when you need to hire fast, accelerate your results with sponsored jobs. New users can try for free when you sign up at Indeed.com/NPR podcast. Terms, conditions, and quality standards apply.
Facebook's digital currency is in doubt after the departure of several key partners. MasterCard, Visa, and Stripe are among the companies that left the Libra Association, a group that will oversee the development of Facebook's cryptocurrency, Libra. Kurt Wagner has been following this. He's a reporter for Bloomberg. Hi, Kurt.
Hi.
Okay. So Monday was the first official meeting of the Libra Association in Geneva, Switzerland. And the leaders of the project said that 1,500 organizations have expressed interest in joining this project. What does this mean? Does it mean that it's easier for them to replace these companies that have recently announced they're dropping out?
It sounds like that, yeah. So there has been a lot of outreach for joining the organization that's going to oversee this cryptocurrency. And that's kind of the messaging that we're hearing from the association today in response to the fact that a lot of their key partners have bailed on this project. And so, you know, if you're looking for a silver lining today, it would be that not only is this association officially created, but, you know, there might be people knocking on the door to get in.
Yeah, I'm curious, though, MasterCard and Visa and those guys, they're big names. What have they said about dropping out?
Well, a lot of the responses thus far have basically been that either they have other ambitions around cryptocurrency, you know, maybe their own projects that they want to devote time and resources to, or that there's a fear of the regulatory road that this is going to have to go through in order to get approved. And so I think when you look at this, it has to be a strong signal that this is going to be a really tough road ahead for Facebook to get this thing through the kinds of regulatory hurdles that these payments and financial services companies are very familiar with.
Yeah, regulations have been kind of a cloud over Facebook. These regulators have said they're skeptical of this proposal. What are they worried about exactly?
There's kind of been two main concerns. The first is that, you know, this kind of cryptocurrency might be used for some kind of illegal activity, right? So they're afraid that criminals might use it for that. The second concern is that could Libra, if it truly succeeds, actually undermine some of the existing currencies that banks are putting out. So the Federal Reserve, for example, could this pose a real threat to the U.S. dollar? And obviously that is a long-term concern, right? That would require Libra to not only exist, but to succeed tremendously. But those are the kinds of things that you have to think about when you're launching something like this. And those are the things that seem to be, at this moment, scaring regulators the most.
Yeah, we're talking a lot in U.S. terms and European terms, but there are several other unbanked regions in the world that are still viable markets for crypto. I'm just wondering, is this really a big blow in the big scheme of things?
Well, the unbanked is exactly who Facebook has targeted with this project. And their argument is that there are a lot of parts of the world where people can't just walk down the street and get their cash out. It's also a solution, they would argue, to this idea of money transfer across border. You know, if you were to send money from the U.S. to family or friends, in Europe or Asia, that's an expensive thing to do right now. There are some people who might say the regulators that are pushing back against Facebook aren't necessarily the ones who would stand to benefit.
Mm-hmm. And later this month, Mark Zuckerberg is scheduled to appear before the House Financial Services Committee to answer even more questions about Libra. That's Kurt Wagner. He's a reporter for Bloomberg. Kurt, thank you so much for joining us.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
As climate-related events intensify, what will it mean for the insurance industry? Last year, payouts prompted by climate-related incidents totaled $2.4 trillion worldwide. Now, firms not only struggle to calculate risk, but also to figure out how to invest the money that customers pay them in premiums. That's how it works. Insurers invest those premiums, the money grows, and they then use it to pay off claims. But companies they invest in are now being hit by the climate crisis. The economist Mathieu Favas's recent look at this is dire. It's titled, Changing Weather Could Put Insurance Companies Out of Business. He says they need to reinvent themselves as crusaders against climate change. And Mathieu joins us from the Economist studio in London. Welcome.
Thank you very much. Thanks for having me.
And, you know, right at the outset, let's just throw out what some people may be thinking. Many people don't trust insurance companies. You know, they don't trust that they may be struggling financially. And if, say, an insurer began an ad campaign encouraging people to do more about climate change, Americans at least might see that as them trying to profit from disaster. So how do you picture this, what you say insurers should do?
I would say that if an insurer were to advertise and try and encourage consumers to do more about climate change, consumers could see already like an immediate benefit in that, in the sense that being less exposed to climate change, for example, if you build a flood wall or if you put some metallic shutters on your windows, that's doing something to protect yourself and that would lower your premiums. Now, insurance companies also could try and publicize more what risks are posed by climate change. So not just encourage you to do more, but also explain what's at stake and why they themselves are going to pay out more money. Mm. And that will induce at least a number of them not to, for example, to seek to buy houses in floodplains on the coast, where they would be subject to pretty devastating losses if they were to pursue these projects.
Are you also saying that insurers should maybe raise the bar for who they insure? Should they start, you know, punishing people more for not protecting themselves against the climate that we know is here?
What they can definitely do is to offer discounts to people who do these things. But I don't think they should punish people who don't do them.
Yeah.
It's more that if it happens, it's probably going to be done in a fairly natural, organic way, in the sense that as insurers face higher payouts, they will themselves have to pay more to reinsurers, which are the insurers of the insurers. And to do that, they will have to raise their premiums. So this year, for example, in the US, this last quarter, property premiums have been rising by 10%, which is quite a lot, so double digits. And this, in turn, will provoke maybe three things. So either consumer won't be able to afford paying these premiums, they will decide not to do it, or they will just decide that it's not worth it. Or insurers will perhaps try to lower the premium rises by extending exemptions or capping the payouts. And the third thing is regulators observing that premiums are rising may decide that there is a maximum level that the premiums can reach. They will seek to cap the premiums. That may have the effect as well that insurers will think it's no longer worth it for them to stay in business anymore.
Well, and you mentioned the people who may not be insured. Right now, the global gap, as you write, between total losses and insured losses, there's already a huge gap there. people who are uninsured. You know, how much should insurers use their clout to start twisting the arms of lawmakers?
Absolutely, yes. I would think so. They can do more. They are very big investors, the second largest in the world behind pension funds. And then the clout of this money that they invest can make or break companies, sectors, industries. They can twist the arms of lawmakers. They can twist the arms of businesses, too.
Yeah, well, and a lot of the companies they invest in are multinational firms dealing with property and infrastructure. So this is also hurting the insurance industry because, the you know, where they're investing to grow that money to pay themselves but also to pay out the premiums, those companies are impacted by climate change.
That's right. It's a big risk for insurance companies, and it's something they have to think about right now because typically they invest for very long periods of time. You know, it can be quite simple in that, for example, they can think about whether they should invest in fossil fuel producers. They can think about how the energy mix is going to evolve and whether this will impact their investments. But there are things that are far less predictable. So, for example, in Europe recently, we had a backlash against airlines in the wake of climate change protests. And this hurt the valuation of airline companies, which are, you know, less directly tied to energy production, but nonetheless very vulnerable to shifts in public mindsets.
Yeah, you call it future-proofing their business. My dad was an insurance agent, and the one main thing they do is try to figure out risk. Well, that has become alarming. You know, you remind us that floods that were supposed to be rare are not, storms that were supposed to be rare are not. These people who have to figure out risk are probably, you know, spinning.
That's right. It's becoming difficult for a number of reasons. First of all, these large events that we're speaking about are becoming even larger. You know, if you think of Hurricane Dorian just last month, this was the second largest Atlantic storm to ever make landfall. And sometimes these events are not even very predictable. So Hurricane Barry in July caused the largest rainfall ever to hit Arkansas, which is not even the coast. And Barry was not a very big storm. These events are not very easy to foresee. But the tools that insurers use also are not really adequate to the task. They don't really factor in climate change. First, because they use data that typically cover the last few decades. So they kind of describe a world that doesn't really exist. And secondly, because they don't perfectly account yet for interactions between various phenomena.
Interactions between various things. You call this compounding effects, right? So a drought is in and of itself an element, but it also causes wildfires. But that's tricky, as you write, because droughts also keep brush from growing. So, I mean, it's really hard to figure it out.
It's very hard, yes. But to give you an example that's more straightforward and where there's been more progress, sea level rises. This is really going into just one direction. And the impact that sea level rises have on storm surges is already better understood. So we know that, for example, the 20-centimeter rise in sea level at the tip of Manhattan since the 1950s is responsible for 30% extra damage on the total destruction caused by Hurricane Sandy. So you can see that these compounding effects are sometimes very complex. Some of them are a bit easier to understand, but that's for sure. It's making the life of insurers harder in terms of quantifying the risk.
Look, you've said that insurers need to reinvent themselves, be the people that publicize what's going on, what it really means when someone says it's a 1-in-100-year event. But what do you really see for the future of insurance companies? Do you think private insurance companies can survive the climate crisis?
I think so. I think they themselves will survive the climate crisis because even though they are exposed to bigger payouts, they are required by most regulators to hold enough capital to be able to survive the worst year in 200 years. So even though it's really hard to know exactly what that means, because the worst gets worse every year pretty much.
Right.
But premiums being on the rise because of rising losses means that a larger portion of the economy will be uninsurable, which in the end means a shrinking business for insurers, which is bad news for them and for the rest of us.
Tell us more about what you think they should do to better survive the climate crisis.
So the first thing is more immediate, is perhaps to try and delay things becoming uninsurable. They can keep their costs lower. So, you know, they can digitize, they can automatize, they can send drones to disaster areas.
Yes, you point out that insurers are doing this, sending drones into areas after disasters to make sure there's no fraud, you know, to actually see for themselves what's going on. That cuts costs.
Yes, exactly. It's also because it speeds up the claims process. The second thing is something we already talked about, which is incentivize people to take less risk or to adapt to the risk. They can also, when risk become uninsurable, they can partner with the government to put together solutions which are not quite economical but can still work out. But in the long run, it's very important that insurers try to understand better what's at stake. It's particularly true in developing countries where cities grow so fast from one decade to the next, which makes it really hard for insurers to really calculate what's at stake, what's at risk. So that's one thing they can research more, try to quantify more the risk in these countries. Also, they can put some of their models available for others to use to try and evaluate various solutions.
Open source them, so let other people see them.
And then finally, you know, some simple tools could be added to apps that you use to buy homes where you have maybe a risk rating or a projection of how much you stand to lose perhaps from any major events. And these are simple solutions that would be in front of people very quickly and would make the risk really real for them.
Mathieu Favas, his article Changing Weather Could Put Insurance Firms Out of Business, ran in The Economist's recent climate issue. We'll link you to the whole issue at hereandnow.org. Mathieu, thank you so much.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
Bernie Sanders says he's feeling, quote, very well after a heart attack took him off the campaign trail. He'll be among the Democratic candidates at tonight's fourth presidential debate, where health and age are topics that are likely to come up. All of the front runners in the 2020 race are in their 70s, including President Donald Trump. And in this election cycle so far, age has been a major topic.
America's always been considered a young and hungry country. But for the first time, our political stage is being dominated by candidates in their 70s.
But the current frontrunners are the oldest candidates in the race. Can you be too old to be president?
Former Vice President Joe Biden was the target of many attacks, even on his experience, let's call it.
So you didn't want to say age?
I didn't want to say age.
To get a better look at the significance of aging and the ability to lead, we're joined by geriatric doctor Louise Aronson. She's the author of Elderhood, Redefining Aging, Transforming Medicine, and Reimagining Life. Dr. Aronson, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
Let's start with Bernie Sanders. He's been recovering at home in Vermont since his heart attack. You're a doctor. How concerned should we be about a presidential candidate having a heart attack?
I think we should be concerned. I'm a geriatrician. I'm all for people as they age doing whatever they can do. But having a heart attack puts you at risk for more heart attacks, for heart failure, for death. And running for president is hugely stressful. The hours, the grueling, the stress hormones, which really aren't good for a healing heart. I don't think this has to do so much with his age as with his health status. And that is one of the key points about candidates of any age. Health might matter more than age.
I want to play you a clip of Jimmy Carter. He, at 95 years old, is the oldest living president, former president, and he's calling for a presidential age limit.
I hope there's an age limit. You know, if I were just 80 years old, if I was 15 years younger, I don't believe I could undertake the duties that I experienced when I was president.
Dr. Aronson, do you believe this is true? Is an 80-year-old incapable of being president?
No, although not every 80-year-old is capable of being president. So one of the fascinating things about people in elderhood is the tremendous variability. If you take one 2-year-old, absent some catastrophic condition, they're all pretty much the same worldwide. That is not true of 80-year-olds. So you can have 80-year-olds who are gravely debilitated. You can have 80-year-olds who are hugely fit and functional. In geriatrics, we tend to look at an amalgam of things. What health conditions does the person have? Obviously, it's hugely different if you've had a major stroke versus if you need a little thyroid replacement, for example. We look at functional status. How far and fast can you walk? How nimble is your mind? And all these things vary tremendously. So it's harder in old age to use the age per se. Although I have to agree with Jimmy Carter, and I do think there's a point at which the chances you will function adequately for such a grueling job do go down because we become more tired as we get into advanced old age.
You know, I'm thinking about how our population is really aging rapidly, and it's reshaping our workforce. Americans over 65 have become the fastest growing working group in the U.S. I'm really curious from you, do you feel like our popular perception has kept up, where we need to do that work to keep up to what is happening in our environment, in our world, regarding folks who are working and living longer?
I love that question. I do think what's happening now with elderhood is that the extra decades of life that the 20th century's medicine and public health gave us are really taking place in elderhood. So there is this whole new phase in which people might not do the same work they did in adulthood, but want to and can be absolutely engaged. So it's an exciting phase, and I think we do need to culturally catch up with the fact that it's absolutely legitimate to be a person in your 70s and doing all sorts of things, and in your 80s too. Just because it's new doesn't mean it's wrong or impossible.
Presidential candidate Joe Biden, he touts himself. He says there are many upsides to having a president who's older, namely their extensive experience. Others say older Americans may be out of touch with the U.S. population, especially when they're talking about things like record players, which Joe Biden did in the last debate. You work with elderly Americans every day. Do you think that this perception that they're out of touch is a fair one?
Well, I think it's a little age bias. So they're in touch with, you know, one segment of the population. But I think you could argue that a younger candidate who can't speak to things that the older candidates are thinking about and doing is out of touch with them. I think when we say out of touch, we are saying that a certain segment of the population, a certain age band, is the norm. So to say you're out of touch is to say you're in a different group. And when we make different bad, I think we're in trouble. You know, and I also think for the president, no one person can know everything you need to know to be a president. So one of the key attributes, whether this person is young or old, would be to have really good advisors of different age groups so that they're in touch with multiple segments of the population.
That's geriatric Dr. Louise Aronson, author of Elderhood, Redefining Aging, Transforming Medicine, Reimagining Life. Thank you, doctor, for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Tanya Mosley at NPR West in Culver City, California.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now.